Come now, all you mangy dogs. Swab the decks and hoist the sails. The guns on board be needing some proper manning. Pieces of eight and a fine wench on your arm, if your work be not too shoddy. Careful not to flounder too badly, though, or you may have to dance the hempen jig as we see you to Davy Jones. But Jeffy, my boy, on with the show.
Well, shiver me timbers. To our listeners from across all regions of the planet, welcome once again aboard the Robin Hood, flagship to the world's one and only cooperatively inspired charity podcast network, WPRPN. Streaming out live from somewhere off the foggy, flu-frosty shores of Korea's New Year Peninsula, welcome to show number 89 and our premiere episode of 2018. I'm your host, as always, ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. Returning once again to the Robin Hood, this week's guest is none other than renowned veteran ufologist Grant Cameron, here mainly to discuss his latest book, True Reports of One of North America's Biggest Ever UFO Flaps, Charlie Red Star. In 1975, Manitobans reported UFOs over the province almost nightly. The string of unprecedented sightings launched the biggest UFO craze in Canadian history. With multiple reports occurring for well over a year, the mysterious object became widely known as Charlie Red Star. And it is indeed our first streaming show of the new year, 2018. Welcome, everybody. Thanks for dropping by. I am, of course, your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. It's going to be a great year. We've got Grant Cameron in the wings here. Not sure if he's managed to wrap up his hockey game yet or not. And he, there's a few other things that he was up to, but we were not too sure if we'd bring him in on Skype during the intro or not, so we're going to try to do that right now, and hopefully that won't cause too many technical issues, but with these things, you just never know. So, in fact, do we have him now? No, almost. Just stand by, and we should have Grant with us in a few moments here, hopefully, if everything works with Skype. So we got a lot of great questions, of course, to ask him, and we're hoping that we can field some of your questions as well, too, if you have any regarding Charlie Red Star or any other ufological issues. So this is the second time, of course, too, that we've had him back, and it's great that his publicist reached out to us and worked on lining up a new interview here for 2018. Unfortunately, no, it looks like... Okay, yes, we're going to have to do it this way today instead. How you doing, Grant?
Just doing fine, just fine. I can't answer Skype. I can only reply back when people phone. I don't know what's going on.
Oh, that's... Yeah, because we saw that you had a test message up there. Weren't too sure what to make of that, but... That's some funny things going on with Skype from the looks of things then.
I've had this problem for a couple months. I have to know exactly when the call is coming in, and then I just reply to the call, but I can't. In my thing, nothing rings, nothing comes on the screen to answer the call or anything. It's just I can see someone's calling, but I can't reply. So anyway, we're back on. We're on.
Well, hey, it's great to have you back. I guess it was Jimmy, your publicist, contacted us and helped to work on lining up this week's show. It's too bad, you know, we didn't get a few of those links out to you earlier, the ones that we sent to you. If you check your Facebook, you'll have a couple that'll pop up there in the feed. Yeah, it would have given you more of a chance to get those out through your social network and contacts, but that's fine. You know, we'll just, we'll roll with things as they are here at the moment. So, just before we get into the Charlie Red Star, this great book, and I'm really looking forward to this too, of course. The first time around, we talked, as you recall, hopefully, Alien Rock. That's really where the focus was. But I was just wondering, the flu and cold season, is it as bad in Winnipeg as it is here in Korea? I've just recently recovered. It's the sickest I've been, I think, pretty much in my whole life. 2 weeks of this bronchial congested. It's lucky I'm even able to be here today to put this show together.
Yeah, no, it's not as, and there's no major stuff, but I know I heard they opened up 70 beds in the hospital for people who can't have operations so they can take the people that are expected in. So I haven't got, I sort of starting to get something and then it sort of went away. So I'm free so far.
Well, that's good to hear. So no flu for myself per se, just really congested and a lot of, just these bronchial issues and phlegm and whatnot. So hopefully don't come across as too froggy today from this end. But
no, sounds okay.
So we've got you here to talk about Charlie Red Star. You know, this is really quite something. It's one of the most outstanding and memorable, for some at least, incidents reported episodes. I guess it is an ongoing, it was a flap, really, I guess, in ufological parlance. The manuscript you'd set aside for quite a few years, and then was it your sister said, yep. Hey, Grant, by the way, did you forget about this? What? Just kind of back us up a little bit and give us some context. And even before we do that, in fact, maybe for people that don't know, just a quick overview, because, I mean, I'm clear on things pretty much here, but some of our listeners may not have a clear sense of who Grant Cameron is. That's probably the best place to start, and then we can transition into how you managed to come across the old buried manuscript.
Okay, well, it basically starts with sort of the manuscript that, you know, I had the sightings in 1975. I read a manuscript. Nobody wants to publish it as to what happened in this small town. And I say, sightings are a total waste of time, which I still sort of believe. And I said, you know, all I'm interested in is what did I see? Because I went out there and I had two up-close sightings, one right after the other. Never thought I'd see anything, and I saw it. So what happened was all I was interested in is somebody must know what I'd seen. So I started this pursuit of trying to find the highest level people that I could find to give me the answer. So I chased the former Canadian government, what the Canadian government was doing between 1950 and 1954. That led to Dr. Eric Walker, who was the former president of Penn State University and an assistant secretary of defense in the United States. And his files, checking his files, led to the president of the United States. And I figured, oh, this guy's got to know what's going on. And so I spent, I guess, 2 decades chasing the president around. And then while I was doing that, I ran across this guy by the name of Dr. Ronald Pendolfi, who I've chased for 20 years, the former he's a CIA guy who I believe is a guy who briefs the president. He's briefed the last 6 presidents. So I've watched very carefully what he says. And then I got, even though I got into consciousness and all this kind of stuff, I got dragged back into this whole Tom DeLonge, you know, this New York Times article thing, dragged back into the disclosure thing. And I'm pretty much 24/7 working on that story right now.
And, it appears we've just lost function and use of our keyboards here, so this is going to be a bit of an issue as things carry on here over the course of the next not quite 90 minutes or so. So, yeah, and there's been a lot, of course, that's been coming to the surface, I guess, and a lot of talk in the mainstream media the last month or so as far as the business of disclosure is concerned. We maybe want to get into that at the end of things here today.
I know as much as anybody, so.
Well, you certainly do. Yeah, that's one of the reasons we had you back. And just to let listeners know, and for yourself as well, too, to be clear, Grant, we typically don't go looking for the more well-established names in any area, largely because we feel they've got enough exposure as it is. It just so happens, though, that you were kind of one of our favorites in the area of ufology, and we thought that what you had to offer was quite...
Well, thanks.
Yeah, it was quite something. Yeah. So... and I know we're kind of bouncing around a little bit here, but, you know, geez, Canadian expat living here in Korea the past 15 years, not a lot of hockey coming our way here. So you, I guess, just were eyes glued to the TV set. Who was playing?
Our local team, the Winnipeg Jets, is actually one of the top teams in the league, and we've always been the loser team. So now they're winning, and everybody's kind of glued in. But they're getting beat tonight. They've actually lost to Chicago. So, but they don't lose many games this year. So, because I live in Winnipeg, which is the coldest major city in the world, it's a place that not many people want to come to. It's a fairly big place, but it's fairly cold during the winter and not very popular. So. We have our hockey, and it's our sort of pride and joy.
Yeah, definitely picked up on that, especially with you in particular, just giving a quick look at your Facebook portfolio there. You've got a couple of hockey-related photos and whatnot, so hopefully not too much money riding on these games, because you never know which way things are going to go, of course. No. So my brother actually works out of Calgary. He's been, for the longest time, part of the farm system there.
Working. Oh, is that right?
Yeah, he works at all kinds of different, well, the highest ranks mostly is what it seems. So,
wow.
Yeah, cool. I guess that would be the enemy though, wouldn't it? The opponent there.
So. Yeah, they're doing pretty good too. The Calgary team's pretty doing fairly well. I think they've won six. Right, they won their sixth in a row tonight. So that's big anywhere in Canada. Is sort of like, you know, curling and hockey, and most people in the world don't even know what curling is. And here it's like major sport. So
sure. Well, maybe if you stick around, if you have time or interest, we could save a little more of that hockey talk for the after show.
Yep.
But in the meantime, I think it's best to shift our sights and focus back to this manuscript. Quite a story to how you just basically, I guess, you set it aside, or was it lost
well,
for quite a few years?
No, I wrote the manuscript, and then I tried to get it published. This would be 1977. The sighting started in 1975. This is this town called Carmen, Manitoba, which had these sightings and almost nightly. Then the local TV studio actually got a film. They got this thing on the ground that captured this thing jumping off the ground. The video went viral. NBC picked it up. It was all over the place. And it was at that point I said to my friend, I said, you know, instead of driving around the city, let's drive out to Carmen and see what they're looking at. I had no interest in UFOs, no interest whatsoever. I can't even remember having thought about extraterrestrial life. I was into near-death experiences. I'd done a paper at the hospital dealing with dying people. Do they see, you know, people coming to visit them before they die? Near-death experiences. Anybody predict their death? You know, anybody get up and walk away? That, you know, miracles. And I was into weird stuff. But not UFOs. And so my friend said, okay, so we went out there, and I always describe it as you buy the lottery ticket, and you know there's a chance you're going to win, but you know you're not going to win. You're not. Everybody else is going to see it. You're not going to see anything when you go out there. And an hour after we were out there, the thing flew right in front of the car, and it was close. It was not a light in the sky. This is an object in front of the car. And I just sort of – my friends were just as shocked as I was, but I just fell off the edge of the earth. I could not get enough. I was out there – two nights later, the thing flew right at us the second night. And then I started to investigate all these people, and I talked to all these people in the town, and I had, you know, lists of like hundreds of people that I had to interview that, you know, everybody was seeing this thing. It was like the high school, I think it was over 50% of the kids in the high school claimed they'd seen this thing. So it was a big, big story. And I took it back and I figured, you know, this is like, we're going to have Hollywood movies and all this kind of stuff. And I put it through Toronto, and one company read the manuscript. And they really were interested. And then the local publisher, who should have published it, because this is a big story in 1975 here. So this is 1977, said to me, Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers. And I went, whoa. I was just shocked. I figured, like, she didn't see it. She thought it was a waste of time. And then I said, okay, this is not getting me anywhere here. I mean, you can tell these stories, and nobody cares. Like, I can tell you my stories. I had five close encounters. I can tell you the stories, and people go, oh, that's kind of cool, you know. But in the end, it's just my story. It really doesn't prove anything to anybody. So that's when this woman basically told me to get lost, the local publisher, I said, this is a total waste of time. And that's when I said, all I was interested in was who knew what I – somebody must know what I saw. Somebody must have the answer to this thing. And I started on this pursuit. And when it comes down now, people talk about disclosure. And I'm actually doing an update on this Tom DeLonge story next Thursday. And I'm going to make public. I don't think I ever made public. I could care less about disclosure. I have no interest whatsoever. It's an external event. It's like people think, you know, if you get disclosure of UFOs, you know, suddenly, you know, somebody's going to crawl down the chimney and give you free energy and all this kind of stuff, that the world's going to change. It's not. It's an external event. You basically have cards that are dealt to you, and you deal with your cards. So I couldn't care less whether there's disclosure or not disclosure. It doesn't change my life. It doesn't change anybody else's life. All I was interested in is I had to find out what I saw. It was like a chess game to me. It's always been like a chess game to me. And so anyway, I had the manuscript, and I gave it to my sister, because my sister actually had a library at one time where she had library cards, and you had to sign out books out of her. And she was like, she's like the hoarder of the family, you know, collects everything, the historian and stuff. And I gave her the manuscript. I said, you know, here, you can have this manuscript. I gave it to her for whatever reason. And then it was like 25 years later, or maybe even 30 years later, she came back to me and said, oh, you remember you gave me this thing? And I looked at this thing, and I couldn't even remember writing the manuscript. I thought I'd written some chapters or something. So at that point, that was when digital or optical scanning was available, where you could optically scan a manuscript. And it was like a typed manuscript. So I scanned it into a computer, made the alterations, the changes, whatever. And then I had a copy that was a digital copy that I would let people read. And I still had no intention of publishing anything. I had no interest, whatever. I was into, you know, chasing the CIA and the president and all this kind of stuff. And I thought I was going to solve this. And I got into the consciousness thing. And then what happened was there was a publisher in Toronto. It's a bizarre story. A publisher in Toronto who runs TV producer, does TV children's shows, who's had some experiences herself. And she said, can I read your manuscript? I heard you got this manuscript about 1975. I said, yeah, okay, whatever. So I sent her the manuscript. She contacts me back, and that's when she says to me, she said, oh, this is exactly what I'm looking for. I'd like to option it for a movie. And I said, yeah, whatever, if you want, you know, I don't really care. And she said, we got to publish this thing through a publisher. And I said, well, I publish my own stuff. I really don't want to go through a publisher, because the publisher will say, which is actually what happened, you got to cut this thing, take 30,000 words out. And then, you know, they wanted a release from everybody that had been quoted in the book. I said, well, basically everybody. And this is like UFO stories. If you know UFO stories, nobody's going to sign a release. Oh, yeah, you can put my story in there and tell my story. Nobody's going to do that. So I had to change all the names in the book. And so she said, it's got to be through a publisher, because we're going to do this movie thing, and it's going to come out at the same time as the movie. So I said, okay. I played the game, and we put it through Dundurn in Toronto. She negotiated with them. I didn't negotiate. I couldn't care less. She went and negotiated the contract for the book. And so the book was a go. And then she got sick, and the movie went on the shelf. And now she's talking about bringing the movie back, because – and it's not in the book. Like, you've got the book, but what happened after the book was the most bizarre part of the whole story. And that was that the book was actually finished, went public on August the 12th. So the publicist who contacted you – I had a U.S. publicist and a Canadian publicist they had on this thing, because I have a very sort of high profile in the States because I do the presidents. They're starting to do these interviews. And I said, well, I'm going to California in August, and I can't really do any interviews while I'm on the road. So they postponed all the interviews until the end of August when I got back. And the reason I was going to California is I was going to go sit on the side of a mountain and meditate for world peace, which is the last thing I wanted to do. I mean, but I had a very close friend who had helped me publish a lot of my books. She had done some editing for me and stuff like that. And she's a Latino, and these Latino people go sit on the side of Mount Shasta and they meditate for world peace. And so I said, okay, Katarina wants to go. She's helped me. So I said, okay, Katarina, I'll come and support you. I'll go sit on the side of this mountain and meditate for world peace. But it's run by a contactee, and these are these Latino contactees. And this is what I say is the best story I've seen in 42 years. So this Latino contactee is there, and they have this thing where they have what are called program sightings. They have people in these groups, and this is the Project Rama. Now, the key that ties this weird story together is that the woman who optioned the book out of Toronto was doing a movie on Project Rama. And Project Rama is this group that started in 1974, and my sightings are in 75. And they had this encounter where the guy starts doing automatic writing. They get in contact with this alien. They say, well, how do we know we're talking to an alien? And the alien says, well, Saturday night at 8 o'clock, you come to this place south of Lima, Peru, 60 miles south of the city, and we'll fly by. And this became known as program sightings. So they have these antennas who do this automatic writing, who pick up these signals, and it tells you to the minute, actually to the minute, when the sighting is going to take place and where. So she wanted to do a movie on Project Rama, on this group. And what they did is the aliens would land. They'd have these what are called Zendras. So they're like interdimensional portals where they open this like a bubble, an interdimensional bubble, and people go into these Zendras. And so she wanted to do a movie on this Project Rama. And I said, yeah, I don't really care. Whatever, you know, if you pay your option for the movie, I don't care what the movie's about. And what she couldn't get it financed in Canada. So the reason they wanted the Charlie Red Star story out of Carmen was they were going to do the movie and they were going to say, okay, there's this reporter. They're going to change me to a reporter. The reporter goes to Carmen. He looks at all these sightings or whatever, and he's investigating this whole thing. And suddenly he discovers Project Rama, because then they would finance the movie, because the Canadians would finance it, because it's got a Canadian angle to it. That's the only reason she wanted the book. So the weird thing was that the Project Rama people deal with all these aliens from the planet Apu. And the Ganymede on the moon of Jupiter, Ganymede is the other place that they're on. And there's been piles of these contacts. I think there's 10,000 of these Project Rama people. They open these Zendras all over the place. I found this after this event. So anyway, I tell this woman, whatever, I don't really care. Do you want to read the script? No, I don't want to read the script. And I'm heading for Mount Shasta, where this contact is, coming through Nevada. And the girl that's with me, her cell phone rings. And she's got the cell phone, and it's this girl that wants me to go sit on the side of the mountain, this Katarina, who's in Los Angeles. She said, I got a meeting. I got a message at 12:13 from Paula Harris. Paula Harris got this message from Ricardo Gonzalez, who's the contactee, who's going to be running this event. And he's got a message from Aunt Terrell. And Aunt Terrell says he knows that Grant's coming to the mountain, and there's going to be a program sighting on Saturday night. And I went, I couldn't believe it happened, because Aunt Terrell is from the planet Apu. So this woman is writing this script, which I have nothing to do with. And so I'm going down to Mount Shasta, and suddenly I get a phone call, a message from this alien. And I put it on my Facebook, and Saturday night there's two antennas who say the event will take place at 9:33 at night. I'm sitting there 9:33 right above my head, and this flashing thing starts. And it was just – I mean, it just blew me away. And at the same time, there were a bunch of the people that were there were involved in a Zendra event in 2014-2015. And in this Zendra event, where there was a 10-foot-tall alien, two shorter aliens, and then these little tiny 4-foot-tall aliens that weren't grays, but little 4-foot aliens that had these iPads that were poking around and poking out from behind trees, there was 10 people in this Zendra. And I started interviewing these people on camera. And I went to you and I said, what do you see? Were you in this Zendra? Oh, yeah, and this alien. And he had a thing on his chest, this sort of a medallion on his chest. And there were sparks coming off it. And everybody described the same alien, the same hair, the same bicycle outfit, tight bicycle suit that he had on. And so that was this whole story. And I went back after and started doing the Charlie Red Star interviews. But then I was interested in the story because it was just so bizarre that it all tied together with this story of these contactees who are dealing with this alien from the planet Apu. And I've now got three messages from this alien. I'd gotten a message from an alien before, from Chris Bledsoe, this very famous contactee from North Carolina. And he said, the Guardians gave me a message for you. And that is the messages in the music. And I had no interest in music. And only because one of the messages that he got, or one of the songs that he believed was involved, was Neil Young, who grew up in Winnipeg. And as I said, Winnipeg is a place where nobody really wants to come. Nobody cares about it. And he grew up there. And that's what got me into the music thing. So when I got this second message from this alien, I figured, oh, I know enough to listen. And I played along with the game. And then I had this event take place over my head. And then I started to realize how many people have been in these Zendras. There's been some Zendras with 125 people that have gone through them. There's one in Northern California where the 747 airline pilot, United airline pilot, went through this. It was one of 50 people that went through them. And they basically talk about this interdimensional aspect to the whole thing, which interests me because my main thing is consciousness. That I say that unless you understand consciousness, you will never understand the UFO phenomenon. That is the core to the whole UFO phenomena. So because this Zendra thing involves this interdimensional thing where you're popping in from one world to the other, I was interested in that, and I have also for a couple of years been chasing the head scientist for the CIA, this Ron Pandolfi, the guy who briefs the president, and he's on this disclosure thing that they're going to release the fact that there is a portal technology that has been developed in the United States. So that's where it all ties together. It's this interdimensional aspect, and it all starts with this, these sightings in 1975 that I thought were totally insignificant, totally didn't mean anything. And now it's sort of like taken over my life again. Not so much the sightings, but the events that happened after the book were published.
Just amazing. So a couple quick questions here in conjunction to what you've kind of laid out for our listeners. One is, when was the date exactly of this second sighting? And secondly, how do these aliens contact you over your cell phone?
Okay, the first question, the two sightings I had were in May of 1975. One was, on, I believe, on a Thursday night. It flew right in front of the car. There was three people in the car. And I dragged all my friends. I said, you've got to see this, man. I couldn't. I mean, you won't believe this. Dragged all my friends out on the Saturday night. And they all left an hour later. They said, we're going back to Winnipeg for pizza. But 15 minutes later, this thing came the second night, and it came right at me. And then I couldn't get enough of it. I mean, I was going to university at the time, and I said, okay, now I know what I'm going to do. I echoed the university, this nonsense. I still went to university, but I wasn't really keen on doing it. So that's what started, and I had five close-up sightings. I had a number of sightings in 75, 76 with these, now they call them orbs. We call them ground lights. And then the Canadian government guy told me they were called monitors. So we had these experiences in 75, 76. The book wasn't, nobody published it in 77. And then your second question, oh, it was about the message from the alien. That came through the girl that wanted me, her name is Katerina, the one that wanted me to go because she's Latino and all these people are Latino. The whole thing was in Spanish. I had no idea what he was talking about. They were doing these meditations and all these group things. They had about 150 people there. And I had no idea what anybody was talking about. It was all in Spanish.
And this is at Mount Shasta.
Yeah. And they have these events every year there. And in 2013, Michael Sala had one of these programmed events. 2014 with the Zendra event with nine witnesses in it. 2015, I think there was 10 witnesses in it. And I have a YouTube channel, White House UFO YouTube channel. And I put a lot of those videos of these people that I was at the Mount Shasta when I videotaped these people. And I'm asking them, well, you saw this alien, and all these people basically were describing this whole event with this alien in there. So when I went, I didn't have the Zendra event. That's what I thought would happen. Cause I got this message, and that's what happened to these other people. Like Michael Sala was told beforehand there was going to be a programmed event. Paula Harris was told there was going to be a programmed event. So I figured there were going to be another one of these Zendra events in the forest. So they do the fasting and the no meat and all this sort of stuff. So I said, okay, you know what, I'll play the game because this is Wednesday when we're going across the desert. We're just heading there. And Katerina is still at work. She's in Los Angeles. She's still at work. And she got this message and it came through a chain of people, but it went back to this Ann Terrell, who the guy who's running these events, he runs it every year there. His name is Ricardo Gonzalez, and he's had a number of encounters with this being, and he was the one that opened up the Zendra in 2014, 2015. And so I figured there would be a program event would be a Zendra. Now, there was no Zendra, but there was this thing that definitely, when I looked up, I thought, this is going to sound egotistical, man, but man, this thing looks like it's right over my head. I could not believe it. Then the message came as soon as the event was over. This guy started the automatic writing thing, and it's in the dark. It's freezing cold, and we're up in the side of this mountain, up pretty high, and his wife is holding his cell phone, which is lighting up this paper. And I knew when I saw it, I mean, man, this guy's doing automatic writing. His hand was just moving at like 100 miles an hour, and I was just really angry I didn't have my camera. I had a movie camera there, and I didn't take it to this circle, and I would love to have videotaped him with his message. And the message again had to do with me and had to do with Paula Harris and all this kind of stuff. So I was sort of blown away because I knew there was so many. And then after the event, when I really got into it, because I went, man, these – and the woman, one of the what they call the antennas, actually was a PhD psychologist who graduated from Columbia University. And she showed me the message. She got the message the day before the event started, like on the Wednesday or the Thursday. And I looked at it, and it said 9:33 or 9:32. I can't remember what the exact time was. And that's exactly when this thing happened. And I was sort of floored. And that's when I started looking at all these other people that had Zendra events. And I went like, oh, my goodness. I couldn't believe how many of them had. And it's totally a Latino phenomenon. Most people in the English-speaking world don't know anything about it because it's all – these people are all Latino. So that's why I saw my role I said, I got to bring this story to the English-speaking people because I had never seen a story that good. In fact, there was another group, a Rama group across the road, and they were sort of like, you know, doing their own thing, or our group didn't want to join with their group or whatever. And so when it was all over, this guy's name was Enrique Villanueva. So I contact him and I said, we had an event Saturday night. This thing was flashing, 9:33. I said, you're on the other side of the road and they're doing the same thing. They're doing the meditation, trying to raise the frequency and trying to open Zendras and trying to have this contact with these programmed events and open up these Zendras. And he said, oh, yeah. And he sent me this video, 32-minute video. And it was like we were sleeping on our side. I mean, I just interviewed the guy and he had aliens. He had this event at 9:08, I think it was, where he had this impression it was going to be 9:08 because he's the antenna. And 9:08, there's this orb going around. There's this woman that disappears. She's leaning against a tree. She disappears. And then he looks and these aliens are standing there. And it's almost the same thing, these big, huge, tall aliens and these shorter aliens. And that happened the same night, like 20 minutes before our event. And I'm thinking like, my goodness, I've never seen a story like this. So I basically started writing up that book and trying to interview these people. And a lot of the people didn't want to go on camera. When I went there with the camera that day, when all these people were there from the 2014-15, they basically didn't want to go on camera. But when you got them on camera, they would basically, in their sort of broken English, would say, yeah, yeah. And the one guy, in fact, I said, because Paula Harris, who was sort of the main figure, a big researcher who was taken into the Zendra both in 2014-2015, had said she was so scared that they were actually basically carrying her out to they go from this open field into the forest, and it's like pitch black, and she's freaking out both ears. So I said to the one guy, oh, Paula was kind of upset, you know, she was very frightened by the thing. Were you frightened? And he said, no, not really. And I said, no. He said, I've seen him before. I said, what, you've seen this Antarel guy before? Oh, yeah. How many times have you seen him? He goes, I don't know, 5 times, maybe more. I don't even really keep count, because this was the thing. These people follow these contactees around, and there are about maybe six of these main contactees that are able to open these Zendras. So I got fascinated with that story and basically had the book almost ready to go, and then suddenly this Tom DeLonge thing blew up and I got dragged away. But I'm hoping to get back to this story because I think it's the best story there is. And it has to do with this whole thing about portals, consciousness, that when this gets confirmed, that there are portals, that consciousness is a key element, everything changes, because then the materialistic paradigm, which is, I think, is what's holding back the UFO story, because it's science that's blocking it. It's not media that's blocking it. It's not the government that's blocking it. It's the scientists. And the scientists, because everybody doesn't want to talk about it, because the scientists will say, you're crazy. You just believe you're having these experiences. You can't get here from there. The distances are too big and all that sort of stuff. But once you get portals and this kind of stuff confirmed, then it's all over. Then the materialistic paradigm of the world sort of dissolves, and all the scientists suddenly realize that, you know, their $30,000 a year or $40,000 a year that they spent going to MIT was a total waste of time. Basically, everything they believe is totally wrong, and that you have this consciousness is the prime basis of the universe, not matter. Consciousness is first, matter comes second.
Almost like something straight out of Star Trek, I suppose, if you think about it, with the, I'm not sure, what did they call it on Star Trek again, with the beaming people down to different planets and
yeah, so forth. And so that's what I thought when I first heard it, because the CIA guy, this Ron Pandolfi guy, they were leaking this story that they had this portal technology, and Joe Firmage's name came up, that Joe Firmage had developed this portal technology. And when I first heard it, I thought, because I don't really watch science fiction, I've never really gotten into it, because I always figured it would interfere with confusing it with things I knew for fact that I'd researched. So I never got into science fiction. But when I heard the portal thing, I'm going, ah, come on, this is garbage. Come on, portals. I mean, that's like science fiction. Like, they're just making this crap up, you know? And I remember Ron Pandolfi, I actually got called in. I don't know if you know this story. I actually got called by a producer out of Hollywood, and he said, U.S. intelligence wants me to contact you. And I said, oh, come on. I mean, I'm a Canadian. Why would U.S. intelligence say to talk to me? And he said, oh, because you know about the Avery. And I said, well, yeah. And he said, you're in. You can be in on this deal. We're going to tell you what we're going to do. And this is like a disclosure thing. This is like the Tom DeLonge thing. We're going to do this thing, and you can be on the inside. You can be on the phone calls. You know what we're going to do. And it had to do with this Ron Pandolfi, this CIA guy. And I said, well, no, I really don't want to be involved now. I'll help you. I'll give you whatever you want. I have no problem with that. But I don't really join things. Like I've never belonged to any group. I always defined it like I'd rather be a chess player than a chess piece. And he said, well, if you're on the inside, you get 100% of what's going on. You'll know exactly what's going to happen. If you're on the outside, you'll only get 10 to 15%. And I said, okay, I'll take the 10 to 15%. I just don't want someone telling me you can't talk about this. Now we're going to do this and you got to keep quiet or whatever. Whatever people say to me is basically on the record. And I'm getting older. I haven't got time to wait another 20 years for you to play your little games or whatever. It's like, so that's when the portal thing started. And that's when I said to this producer, and he said, in the last two episodes are going to be on portals. And I said, what, you mean this portal thing's for real? And he said, oh yeah, that part of the story's real. And I said, are you kidding me? Come on. And he said, yeah, I've been through one of these portals. And then he mentioned Joe Firmage and some of these things. And I'm going, wow. I mean, I was just sort of floored. But I thought it was total nonsense when I first heard about it. And that from time to time, I still have my doubts because there's these offers that they're going to take someone through. And until I have some close friend or somebody or myself or somebody really close to me that actually goes through it, because they have made some offers and I've talked to people who sort of were closer to me because I don't get involved. I stay on the sidelines. And I would say to them, you're pretty close. You're dealing with these people. Is there actually a portal? And then the person would say, yeah, I think so. And I go, okay, I'll hang in there. But I mean, that's like the Zendra thing is for sure. We got pictures of Zendras. We got videos of Zendras. I've got these 10 people, in each event where I'm interviewing them. That we know for a fact. We know what a Zendra is and we know these things exist and probably thousands of witnesses by the time we gather it all together that have been through these things. But the portal thing is still, you know, it's like at one point they said it could be animal, vegetable, mineral. It could be in your mind. And I'm going, come on, this is stupid. Like, what are we doing this stupid thing for? And yet the idea was that Joe Firmage, who had this .com big company, had made piles of money in the 1990s. Big time had a real encounter where beings were in his room and had given him downloads and stuff like that. The rumor story is that he has some sort of portal technology and he's developed this. And so I'm going to hang in there and I'm going to try to get one of my friends or somebody to go through one of these things. And I said, when I confirm this, that this is for real, everybody's going to know. Because to me, this is the biggest story. It's got to do with this idea that it's not a physical world the way people think it is. And the same thing with UFOs. I say, if you really understand the UFO phenomenon, what's going on, you're going to suddenly realize it's a lot less physical than you think it is. And it's a lot more spiritual than people think it is. And a lot of people are really going to be blown away by that. And that's what Ron Pandolfi said in some of the stuff that he's leaked out. He said, a lot of people, when disclosure comes, are not going to be happy with what it turns out to be.
Yeah, and that's one of the things we're hoping to get into. But we've also got I'd like to backtrack a little bit and get more into Charlie Red Star. We've got about 15 people joining us here as part of the live streaming chat that we put together every week. There's a few questions that have been coming in. Maybe save those for the end. What, once again, I'd like to do is just kind of backtrack to 75, I guess, and really... For example, we have streaming on our slideshow here a couple of pictures that were taken by one Mr. I'm not sure his first name. Let's see if we can get it here. Freddie Giesbrecht. There we go. In Carmen, Manitoba, 1975. There was some video, I believe, shot by a local TV crew as well. That's the only surviving either video or picture content that survives to this day. Is that right?
No. That's the two, that's the key ones that Freddie Giesbrecht was a professional photographer and she spent every night for about a year and a half trying to film this thing. So she had cameras set up in her living room that were pointed out with big, huge telephoto lenses on it. She would go with these film crews. When I was going to first publish the manuscript in 77, I went to her and she had they were all in slides and she had a binder full. She must have had 300 photographs. And what I did is I took the three best photographs that she had that were taken 1 minute apart on this date in 1975, where she had these time lapse where you could see these the time lapse. And I bought those for $100 for the book. But she had many other photographs. I had a pile of photographs, especially of these ground lights or these monitors on the ground. We had piles. We had infrared photographs. We were doing a lot of filming of this kind of stuff. And then we have the one, the film that really got me to go out there is the one you're referring to with this TV station. And that was CKY TV, which is a affiliate here in Winnipeg. They were going out, and the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was also going out. The big government station was going out, and they were trying to film because this was a big story. I mean, everybody knew this thing was there, and these crews were out there trying to film this thing. So CKY went out the one night, and they saw it, but they weren't able to get it on film. So they went back to the news producer at CKY, and they said, we just about got it. We want to go out again. And it's a big crew. I mean, they have reporters and the film guy and all this kind of stuff. And then the assistant news producer said, this is total garbage. Nobody's going out again. We're wasting money. No, I'm not paying any more overtime. You guys want to go out and chase this stupid thing? You can go out on your own time. So what happened was these guys were so enthralled because they'd seen this thing and they thought they could get it on film, that they all went out on their own time, which was the big kicker. They went out and they had no cameraman, so they got a film editor from the film room to shoot the camera. He'd never shot one. These are big, huge cameras back in 1975. And you got to remember, in 75, it's not like today. In 75, when you're taking photographs, we're using 35mm film with Nikon cameras, and you need tripods to shoot these pictures. So that's why there's so few photographs in those early days at night, because you had to be in the right place, and you had to have the camera set up. You had to have it on a tripod. Otherwise, it's just going to be like a big mess on the film. So they went out on the night, and this is where I sort of think, you know, looking back 30 years later, that this wasn't a random event, because what happened was they were out there and they saw this thing on the ground, and it would glow up and it would go back down. It would glow up and it would go back down. And so what they did is they have what are called mile roads. So north and south, east and west, there's these mile roads. Every mile, there's a road, and it makes this checkerboard pattern across the country. So they put somebody on the mile road on the north side of it, somebody on the mile road on the south side of it, and these cars go down to where they think this thing is, and it's way down off in the distance. And the one car from the road, the north side, figures it's close, and they come across, and they suddenly they're right there, and this thing is there. And there was, I think there was 10 witnesses in the two cars, and I think there was four pilots, editor of the newspaper, the publisher of the newspaper, a couple of the reporters from the newspaper. These are high-level witnesses that were seeing this. So the one on the north side comes across, and they're right there. And this thing is behind a set of trees, and there are no trees in the area except they have these windrows of trees. So they'll grow one row of trees just to catch snow in the winter. And this thing is behind the trees, and the way that was described by the guy who owned the newspaper, who was one of the main witnesses, who was also a pilot, said it looked like a movie screen. It was a 50-foot-high saucer with a dome on it, classic-type saucer, blood red, and it was on a 45-degree angle like an old drive-in movie screen, but it wasn't touching the ground. It was hovering off the ground. And they went, whoa! And so they started taking their perspective, because there's really no towns out there. And they're taking their perspective, looking at microwave towers, to figure out where they are in the countryside so they can come back the next day to see if there's some radiation or something on the ground. And then they look back, and the thing is gone. And they go, what? The thing disappeared. It's gone. They didn't realize that the thing had actually jumped. Meanwhile, they left the camera at the other end of the road. And so when we got the radiation marks in that field the next day, when they went back and found the radiation marks, we know the camera is exactly 8.25 miles away. So the camera is there, and this guy in the camera is looking through the viewfinder, and he's never shot a camera before in his life. And so he knows the night before they didn't get anything. So he said, the next time this thing gets brighter, I'm going to shoot the camera because I want to get something. So as this thing starts to glow up, he shoots, pulls the trigger on the camera, and the thing jumps up in the air. And one of the calculations was done, determined that it had jumped in 3 frames of film, 24 frames a second, in 3 frames, it had jumped 5,000 feet. So it went up in the air, and on the second frame, the first frame it's on the bottom, second frame is what's called a flash frame. For 1/24th of a second, you can see the entire horizon. You can see exactly the horizon and these big, two huge humps of light on the horizon. And in the third frame, it's dark again, and the object is at the top of the frame. And he films this thing going across the sky, and it shows this wave pattern. When they actually get the film, it actually shows the thing jumping in the air and this wave pattern, and it goes viral. And then they have this problem was that they've got this famous film, and they didn't pay anybody to take it. So they give the guy, the cameraman, they give him $100 because NBC wants to interview him. And they say, okay, just keep your mouth shut about the rest of this stuff and just do the interview. He does the interview. So when the whole thing is over, when he leaves the station, he actually takes the film. Now, when I went back to CKY to do the book, they had no film. I know what the film is. The guy took it. He said, they didn't really pay us for this film. They shafted us. So he took this world-famous film when he left. And the other thing that happened was he was making copies. I got a copy back in the 1970s. And he said, no, I don't make copies for people because every time I make copies, the film starts to disappear. And then finally he said, okay. And so he gave me a third generation. He made a third generation copy of this 12 inches of film. And I got it, and I sold my house 7-8 years ago. Do you think I could find that film? It was on a 6-inch reel. And I'm going like, that's what the guy said. The film will disappear. I couldn't believe it. I'm looking through the attic. I'm looking everywhere. I could not find that film. So that was the bizarrest thing that started. And it was a very, very famous film. It was shown in a documentary. People want to see it. There's a documentary called UFO Cover-Up Live, which was filmed in the last days of the Reagan administration in October of 1988. UFO Cover-Up Live. You can see the film. Jacques Vallée is actually narrating this film that they take. A very dramatic film, which sort of was what made me go out, because we were going to go out earlier. And we didn't go out. And my friend said, yeah, we'll go out. But we never did. And it was when they took that second film, when the TV station got the film, that's when I said, come on, let's go. They're still seeing this thing. Let's go out and see it. And when it came down to the guy having to actually pull the trigger and this thing jumped in the air, I'm thinking that 30 years later, I'm going, I don't think that was coincidence. I think they were waiting. They're saying, are you ready to shoot? Get ready. We're going to jump. Get ready to shoot. Because as he pushed the trigger, this thing jumped up in the air. And to me, that couldn't have been random. And then so I started looking at the fact that maybe they wanted me out there, that I wouldn't have gone if it hadn't been for the second film, because I really didn't have an interest in UFOs. And it wasn't until they got that second film. So it was almost like they got caught on the ground and allowed this filming to take place to drag me out there. Because, I mean, my friends all went on with the rest of their life. And I took a lot of people out there. I was taking tours out there to see these ground light things that were, and people would always go to the same thing. It's a car. I say, no, it's not. And then we'd convince it's not a car. Oh, it's a farm light. And we'd convince them it's not a farm light. And then let's go surround it. And it was the same thing every night. And then I would tell people, they'd say, come on, I got some new people I want to go. And I'd say, okay, here's a map. Go here, turn there, turn, 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 go here. Good luck. I'm not going. Cause you couldn't, we tried everything we could to get close. I got close the first night we saw these things on the ground. And that was the story where I tell. I was like 75, 50 feet away from this thing. It was like it was a ball. It was an orb type object. It was on a bridge. It was 2 inches away from the edge of the bridge. I can remember to this day. It was like right there. And it was so close that I said to my friend, hold the camera. I'm going to jump on this thing. Because we had a movie camera. And I was shooting every 7 steps. I'd shoot 3 seconds of film. And suddenly I was like, you know, 50 feet away from this thing. I was close enough that I thought, it was almost like the story in the Bible of Thomas, you know, unless I feel the wound and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I was thinking of this thing and I was going, I got to touch this thing. And I knew that there had been a case in 1967, the Stephen Mikluk case, where this guy had touched the craft and got badly burned by this thing. And I knew there was a chance I could get burned, but I said, I've got to touch this thing because it escaped us twice earlier that night. And now I was close enough that I figured, even if it tries to take off this time, I can get it. I was going to swat it as it was going away because it was like, I have to touch this thing. It was the only time I ever got close to that thing. But we would take a lot of films and it would react to lights. We could shoot lights at it. We'd have infrared film. And we did this for a couple of years. And it was when I tried to publish the book. That's when there was no interest whatsoever. And this one publisher just told me to go, you know, get lost. And that's when I sort of gave up. And I said, all this sighting stuff, all this work I did, it was a total waste of time. It's an interesting story when you read the stories. There's a lot of really interesting stories of things that happened to these people in this small town of 2,000 people. But in terms of convincing people, you know, they're just interesting stories. I think I put that right in the beginning of the book. They're interesting stories that you can tell your grandchildren when they grow old and gray. But it really doesn't prove anything. It's when you get to the portal technology, when you get that kind of stuff, if you can confirm that, then the game is over. Everything starts to unravel and you get disclosure and people actually start to understand what's actually going on.
One of the most interesting stories that I've heard you talk about, actually, I don't think too many of our listeners are up to speed on, involves a young boy who apparently was home alone on his family homestead and had some sort of close encounter from all accounts and indications. Maybe you could get into that a little more. It's quite intriguing.
Yeah, that's a story that I can still see this little kid. It still haunts me to today. It was a situation where this kid lived maybe about 3 miles north of Carmen on this road. It was a small house that had no indoor plumbing. And this kid was urinating off the back porch. And his horse, whose name was Sonny, was there with him. When this story happened, his mother believed that this thing was demonic. And the kid had His hair was falling out. He had nosebleeds. They had actually pulled this kid out of school for about 4 days. But there were, the mother was determined that nobody was going to interview this kid. And the father was determined he was going to find out what was going on. So they brought me out on a Wednesday night. She had gone to church or whatever. And they brought me in on this Wednesday night to interview this kid. And I remember him sitting on the other end of the room. I call him Bobby. I don't want to say his real name is, but we called him Bobby because we had to change all these names because they wanted, you know, releases from everybody that had been quoted in the book. And his father said, Bobby, you come tell Mr. Cameron what happened. And he was on the other side of the room hiding behind a chair. He was 7 years old. He was very small for his age, very thin. And he was just peering out from behind the chair. Come on, tell Mr. Cameron what happened. And then the father starts telling the story. My wife and I were gone. He and his sister were here. And he was urinating off the porch. And this thing just appeared. Tell Mr. Cameron. And he would go and the kid would just look and the kid would not budge. And what had happened was he was there and this thing just appeared. It just suddenly appeared over top of the neighbor's tree, which is maybe about 50 feet high, the tree. And it was right on top of the tree. And he could hear the branches breaking on this tree. And it was big. So he was looking at this thing. And then he said, oh, see that, Sonny? To the horse. And the horse just looked at this thing and had his own little barn. The horse took off and went to the barn. And this kid was standing there and he was just totally petrified. And he was yelling at his sister, come out, come out, come out at this thing. And he was yelling and I don't know, his sister never did come out. And then he went into the house and he got this rifle, big rifle. He'd never shot a rifle before in his life. And he was going to shoot this thing. He was so scared of what he was seeing. So his father basically ends up telling the whole story. And this kid, this Bobby kid, is still sitting there. And so what I did was I had a little page that showed all different types of UFOs. I got on my knees and I went into the middle of the room and I put the piece of paper on the floor. And I said, Bobby, can you tell me what it looked like? And then he looked and he crawled out from behind the thing. And he took a look at this page of maybe 30 different UFO shapes. And he immediately pointed one and he said, that one there. And I said, was it big? And he went, big as a house. And I said, did it have lights on it? Lights all over it. And I said, what kind of lights? All different colors. And then I said, did they all stay that way? All turned white. Lights all turned white. And I said, did it disappear? Over the road. Went over the road. And that would be maybe 20 yards south of where the house was. And then I said, did it just fly away or did it go out like a light? Out like a light. And he's just whispering. He was just like petrified. I can still remember that kid to this day. And I was going to actually go back because he had all the symptoms of an abduction scenario. But I figured he may have gone the way of his mother and believed this is demonic or didn't remember the story. So I never did go back and interview that kid. In fact, I don't think the house is even there. But that was the one where I can still remember this kid just absolutely petrified and his father determined that he said, I told this kid, if he's lying to me, I'm going to strap him to within an inch of his life. I was told him, you better not be lying. And so it was just this thing where the father's all wound up and this kid is, you know, hiding behind this chair. It was just, that was the one that still haunts me to this day when I did that interview with that little kid.
It would likely haunt a few people, I'd imagine. When was the movie Close Encounters of the Third Kind is what I'm thinking of there, partly for sure. What year did that come out? 1977.
Yeah.
So
and that's actually based on a true story, from Bob Emmenegger, who is was given material. Just like now, you see this video being released. Bob Emmenegger had a video released to him of the Holloman Air Force Base landing. He was told it was May of 1971. And in the documentary, he did a documentary called UFOs Past, Present, and Future, which is on the internet on YouTube as UFOs That Has Begun, narrated by Robert Sterling. He told me, you know, they had 8 seconds of the film. He actually confirmed to me that they had allowed him to put 8 seconds of this film of this object coming towards the base. And it was still far away, so they allowed them to use it. But the thing actually landed. It was filmed from three different vantage points. The aliens come out of the craft. It's all on film. It apparently is what they briefed the presidents. The president gets to see this 15-minute color film of these aliens landing. Years I interviewed Bob over these different stories about what he was allowed to put in this documentary and going to the Pentagon and stuff. And it was at one point I said to him, you know, Bob, if it weren't for the location and all this kind of stuff, the Holloman Air Force Base story sounds just like Close Encounters of the Third Kind. And that's when he said, oh, I didn't tell you? And I said, no, you didn't tell me what? I didn't tell you I gave a copy to Steven Spielberg? I said, no, you didn't tell me that. And he said, I told you, Annie Spielberg, his sister, was a line producer. She worked for me. And he was an advertising executive at Gray Advertising in Los Angeles. And they were doing all sorts of documentaries on hypnosis and near-death experiences and stuff like that. And Annie Spielberg worked for him. And Annie had said to him, Steven would like a copy of your documentary, which came out in 1975 with the Holloman Air Force Base story about them waiting for this UFO to land. And there's all the cameras are ready and it's all planned or whatever. And so he said he gave a copy to Annie. Annie took it to Steven. And after the Close Encounters of the Third Kind came out 2 years later, 1977, Bob told me that Steven Spielberg's mother came to him and said, I've seen your version of the landing and I've seen Steven's version of the landing. And I like Steven's version better.
All right. Well, Hollywood magic, I guess, eh? So, yeah. Going back to this, partly to the young boy who seemed to have displayed some real clear memory of the incident, a lot of other witnesses or experiencers that they've also, one of the main things that you find there often occurring is that they are not able to recall anything regarding or surrounding what they've witnessed. So what this, and Charlie Red Star was no different. There's quite a few people, I guess, who were out there and who were a part of things. But then when it comes down to it, their memory seems to fade. Although there's others who recall the whole incident and reoccurring appearances and sightings quite clearly. What's up with this memory business, and in particular as it applies to Charlie Red Star?
Well, actually, Charlie Red Star didn't have that much of that, because you got to remember that in 1975, abductions were really not known. There was Betty and Barney Hill. The movie had come out in 1966, somewhere in 66, 67. There was a story by a guy named Shermer, was a police officer, 1967, but most people hadn't heard that story. There was the Pascagoula case, 1973, which the National Enquirer printed. And then there was Travis Walton. But Travis Walton's was the most famous one. And that was where, you know, he disappears for 5 days. That happened in November of 1975, the same year as mine. But in November of 1975, the whole idea of missing time would not happen until Hopkins wrote the book like 8 years after Charlie Red Star. So in 1975, we really weren't looking for missing time. Nobody knew that there was such a thing as missing time, that abductees were missing time. It was only later that I realized that this kid had the symptoms of being very close to the object, that he had the hair falling out and all this kind of stuff. It looked like he was the one kid that might have been an experiencer. And I had another guy come to me later on who we were filming this object on the ground where we had the infrared and we had these objects on the ground that we were doing all these filmings of. And he came to me, but that was only maybe 10 years ago. He came to me, told me the story, and I said, well, where do you live? And he said, Second Mile Road west of Sperling. I said, are you kidding me? And I said, whereabouts on the road? He said, oh, just on the other side of Highway 3. I said, we were on the other side of the highway for like a year filming these objects on the ground. And so this guy came forward later and told this bizarre story about missing time, about being in his bed and all this kind of stuff. But that was a story I actually had to pull out of the book, because that's what happens when you go through a publisher, is they want 80,000 words. Mine was 125,000 words. So that was one of the stories we had to cut out. But in 1975, we didn't have the abduction type stories. We had other stories. We had the ground trace stories, which don't happen anymore. And that's what people have to realize in ufology, that ufology goes in patterns. Everybody thinks that what happened now happened then. Not true. Not true at all. If you look in the book, I think we had 10 trace things where the thing would land on the ground, would leave the tripod marks, would burn out the crop, all this kind of stuff. That doesn't happen anymore. It hasn't happened for decades. Now you have crop circles and stuff like that, but you don't have these landing trace where it burns out the grass and stuff. And we had the stuff where you have the little alien coming out, where the craft lands and the alien's walking around picking up rocks and plants and stuff. That doesn't happen anymore either. We have those cases in the book. Now we have completely different stuff. We have the abduction. We have the experiencers, all that kind of stuff. But that really wasn't being reported in the 1970s. That's where I think people have to really realize it's almost like we're watching them turn the pages of a book. For example, like stalled cars. That was big in the 50s, 60s, 70s. That doesn't happen anymore. Nobody reports stalled cars anymore. Nobody reports UFOs with windows in them.
You used to get them all the time with Windows. There was the whole thing about angel hair in the 50s, 60s, 70s, that the UFO would fly and this white, almost like a spider web stuff would fall and hang off the trees. That hasn't happened for 20 years. And it's almost like they're leading us through a pattern. And almost like you have, in 1895, you have the airships. And they're like wooden ships with propellers and guys hanging off of ropes and stuff like that. And then you have the Foo Fighters. And then the Foo Fighters change to the green fireballs. And then the green fireballs turn to the Adamski-type craft. And then it turns into the classic flying saucers. And now it's triangles. And this is the thing. It's almost like you say, well, what happened to the green fireballs and the Foo Fighters? And I say, well, they're on another planet 100 years behind us. And when the Foo Fighters are finished there, then they're going to send in the green fireballs. Then they're going to send in. It's almost like it's a pattern that the aliens may have done this on 1,000 different planets. They know exactly what they're doing, and they're going through this thing. First you send in the Foo Fighters, then you send in the green fireballs, then you send in these contactees, and you go through this sort of process. So in the 75, we had some really bizarre stuff of crafts breaking into pieces, and some of the stuff that still does happen. For example, a lot of the things we had, there was a chapter I wrote called "It's Funny They Should Be the Same," where you'd get these things where people were reporting something very bizarre that you just wouldn't make up. And the one that still does appear is you have a big craft flying along, and then suddenly a bunch of little crafts come out of it, and they fly around, and then they go back into the big craft. Now, that still is reported. We're getting those back in the 1970s as well. But now it's a completely different world. If I had to do the investigation over again, I would be looking for entirely different things than I was looking for then. Then we were more into, can you get a photograph of the thing? Did anybody see an alien? That kind of stuff, which you really don't get anymore. Like the humanoid sightings, you really don't have humanoids running around outside of crafts. We had the one there, I think it's in the book, where, the guy sees the craft and it's in the field and he actually walks around the craft. It's on the ground and he's looking for a door on this thing. And then he realizes at one point the craft is now between him and the truck where his girlfriend is. And he decides, okay, I got to go back because now the craft is between us. And he goes back, he backtracks around, can't find a door on this craft. It's about 15 feet across, has yellow lights around the thing, has a red light on the top of it. And he goes back, and as he's pulling off the field, he backs out and the lights go through the ditch. And there's this little tiny guy with a rod all dressed in silver. Now that, again, that has not happened for 20 years. You have none of these reports of these little guys walking around with rods in fields around crafts and stuff like that. Completely different world of sightings than what was going on in 1975.
Abracadabra. And once again, my voice seems to be, not sure how much gas we have left in the engine. I'll give it my best shot, though. We have about another 20 minutes or so left to go. And one of the things that I was hoping to ask you about, because I think this kind of ties into things once again, is how, because of the location of these sightings, you think there is a strategic reason. In particular, there was nuclear bases or outposts that were situated and probably still are along the U.S.-Manitoba border. There's a connection there, you believe. Is that not the case?
Yeah, and I did not understand that until this would be 10 years ago. I went back and I was going to do a lecture. I would lecture at Eureka Springs every year. And at that time, I was lecturing there every year, and I wanted to do a different lecture. So I was going to do a lecture on my story, my Charlie Red Star story. There was no book or anything. I was just going to lecture, tell people how it started. And so I went back to the town at that point, like 10 years ago, and I talked to Bob Diemert, who was the head guy. He was the guy that ran the airport. He had 150 sightings. And I said to him, Bob, how many sightings do you have in 1975, 76? He said, about 150. I said, okay, how many have you had since 1976? And he said, none. It was like they took the drugs out of the water. The CIA put the drugs in the water and took it out. It was like there was no sightings. They just went away. And so I said, well, Bob, why were they here? Carmen is a town of farming. There's nothing there. There's no industry. So I said, well, Bob, why were they here? And he said, you know why they were here. And I said, well, no, Bob, I don't know why they're here. He said, you know why they're here? I told you in 1975 why they were here. I said, Bob, it's been 30 years, 35 years. I have no idea why they were here, Bob. I have no idea. He said, I told you, the missile silos. I told you that in 75. And as soon as he said it, I went, oh, and I knew he was right. Because we all knew North Dakota had 300 Minuteman III nuclear missile silos with three warheads on them each. And we all knew that if there was ever an exchange between the United States and Russia, we were gone because every 10th Russian missile is going to land short. And we're only 60 miles from these missile silos. There's no missile silos on our side of the border. But we're only 60 miles away. And we knew that we were gone if there was ever an exchange. And what most people don't realize is that people always think the targeting, who these missiles are targeting. The number one target of the Russian missiles is not Washington. It's not New York. It's not Los Angeles. It's the missile silos in North Dakota, these 300 Minuteman missile silos. Because if you don't take out the Minuteman missiles in North Dakota, you ain't going to see what's going to happen next because you're gone. Those missiles are going to take you out. So you've got to take out those missiles. And so when he said that, I realized that these missiles were there. And what I realized when I started doing research on this, that there, and by then we knew there was a connection. Like Robert Hastings had written on the nuclear missiles. We knew there was the NORAD documents that in 1975, the same year the sightings took place, there was a series of documents that were leaked from NORAD documents that showed at all the Strategic Air Command bases on the Canadian-U.S. border on the northern tier that were had this the B-52s that would fly to Russia and keep these bombers in the air all the time. All of them, Loring Air Force Base, Wurtsmith Air Force Base, Minot Air Force Base south of us in North Dakota, Malmstrom Air Force Base in Montana, all these bases were visited in 1975. And they didn't just visit the base. They were inside the weapons storage area where they kept the nuclear missiles. And I also knew that the whole Rendlesham Forest thing was based on nuclear missiles. That's they appeared at Rendlesham Forest at the end of December of 1980. That's when the Russians had gone back to the Polish border and they were going to reinvade Poland. They had all these troops and tanks on the border. Most people don't know that. And this is where they kept all the forward base tactical nuclear weapons was at Rendlesham Forest. And the aliens showed up there. So I knew there was a nuclear connection by 10 years ago. But when I started doing the research on how these missiles in North Dakota tied in, I suddenly realized that they had built, before Star Wars, when Reagan came in 1980, they were going to do the Star Wars, the weapons in outer space thing. But before 1975, the Star Wars thing, the anti-ballistic missile unit, was in North Dakota. The only anti-ballistic missile unit that ever went operational to try to shoot down Russian intercontinental ballistic missiles was in North Dakota. It was 80 miles as the crow flies south of Carman, Manitoba. They started putting the missiles in there, and they put in 100 new nuclear missiles. So North Dakota had 300. In 1975, they put in 100 new nuclear missiles in this town called Nakoma, North Dakota, and that was to shoot the Russian missiles down as they came in through outer space. And the fact they started putting them in February of 1975, that's exactly when the sighting started. And in November of 1975, they made a treaty with the Russians, and they shut it down and started taking the missiles out. That's when the sightings basically stopped. They sort of trailed off. But after November, there really wasn't much. And so when I looked at it, I went, that's exactly the time when we had the sightings. And it was almost like they were there checking the American thing. And Bob Demert had actually told me that he said, don't you remember, I talked to that pilot on the border in the bar and he told the story. I told you the story that they had one over a nuclear missile silo and they were told to ram it. And they had four jets and they were going to ram this UFO over top of the missile silo. And then the pilot who was talking to Bob Demert said at the end, he figured it wasn't worth my life. And he pulled out of the formation and that UFO came up where his plane would have been and got away. So Bob said, I told you all this stuff. I told you it was nuclear missiles. And when you look at it, there is definitely absolutely a connection between nuclear missiles and the UFOs. That's when it all started. That's it was after the detonation of the Trinity site, 1945. That's when it all starts. It's like the kids have got the matches. And what the Canadian government had stated, the guy that ran the Canadian government program was an experiencer. What he had said was that our atomic bombs don't just affect our little area. They affect the entire universe. So, and if everything is one, if everything's connected in the universe, then once we detonate an atomic bomb, everybody in the universe knows we've done it. And that's when they all appeared. So that is a critically important thing. But I didn't discover it until I mean, most of the things I've discovered in ufology, I got dragged into. I didn't really figure out anything. It just sort of happened. And that was something that was there in 75, but I didn't figure it out until maybe 7, 8 years ago, or 10 years maybe, that I realized that nuclear missile connection to why, because I could never figure out why this little town had these missiles and these sightings. And then they just went away. It was just so weird. They were there and then they went away. And I don't think really anybody's had a sighting there since.
The kids have got the matches. That's a great line. So it's interesting too, to note that there have been apparently multiple reports of these sightings where in fact bases with the silos and the systems they have in place to launch the missiles essentially being hijacked or overridden, if you will, by some sort of means and just at the same time where there are these sightings over the bases. So that's really, I think, quite something to note, too, that there appears to be somebody seems to have the ability to do this. I'm not sure if you want to speak to that or not, but
yeah, well, that's an important principle that they're basically just sending a message that we're running the show here. In fact, the one in Russia, this told by George Knapp, is in Russia, they actually did the opposite. They started the missiles going, and these guys were trying to figure out, how do we turn this thing off? And the countdown was on. They were actually, these things were preparing to launch when these UFOs were over there. And they were just sending a signal. It's the same as if you look at the research of David, I'm going to forget his name. Perkins, the guy who, he has the biggest collection of cattle mutilations. If you look at that, he states that all cattle mutilations are downwind and downstream of nuclear power activities, of radiation testing, all this kind of stuff. And it's the same thing. It's sort of like, you may think, well, you know, why are they mutilating cattle? Why is this thing? And I always say, somebody in the government is going, did you see where that cow was? Because cattle in feedlots aren't taken. The only cattle that are basically taken are free range. So they're testing the cattle that are eating the grass. And there was even a thing that the government was doing it, but it makes much more sense that this is just signals that the aliens are giving. And cattle mutilations, I know Linda will argue with me, but I say cattle mutilations haven't happened for 20 years either. They're happening in other places. They're happening in Argentina and stuff. But in 1975, when my sightings took place, that was the highest level of cattle mutilations in history. In Malmstrom Air Force Base, where they shut the 10 nuclear missiles down, in 1975, they had UFOs over the nuclear weapon storage area, and they had cattle mutilations all around that base. And to me, that was just the being sending messages. I believe that almost all of ufology, all of what the aliens are doing, it's all messages. They're not here to take over. They're not here to steal our gold. They're not here to do anything. They're just to send us messages, to raise consciousness. That is what I believe they're doing.
One of the things that came out of the Rendlesham incident, too, I believe, based on what has been documented, at least with respect in particular to the binary code that emerged, I guess, just over the last couple of years, is how that's definitely part of the deal and what's at stake. And that I'm not sure if it was essentially nuclear war, but that humanity will not destroy itself, that steps will be taken to ensure the survival of the planet and the species.
Yeah, the Canadians have an interesting story. Stopped the UFO thing in Carmen. I went first to the Canadian government. The guy who ran the Canadian government program from 1950 to 54 was an experiencer. He was a contactee. We kept it secret for many years. Now it's a little bit more, you know, appropriate to be say you're an experiencer. Then it was like you were a total nutcase. And he had been in contact with an alien by the name of AFA, which the CIA actually channeled this alien and actually brought him in Washington. There's this famous story where it flies by the window where Art Lundahl, the head CIA guy for UFOs, is in this room, and this story is told. But anyway, so Wilbur Smith is dealing with this AFA, and that was a number one message of AFA, was this thing about nuclear weapons. And Smith talked a lot about nuclear weapons. We've got to stop the nuclear weapon program. And that what AFA had told him, this was through Walt Andrus, told me the story, who was the former head of MUFON, had to talk to Wilbur, that Wilbur had been told by AFA, the aliens, AFA, and PONAR was the other one, they would never step in to interfere. This is not, you know, you're not allowed to interfere with the society, that they would never interfere except if there was a nuclear war. And if there was a nuclear war, they would step in, and that they could stop a nuclear exchange, and that to prove that they could stop a nuclear exchange, they could take the moon in front of the entire world and split it in half and put it back together in front of the entire world to prove that they could stop a nuclear exchange. But other than a nuclear exchange, the aliens are going to do nothing. And the words that were given by Wilbur Smith is, they are going to allow us to stew in our own juices.
Well, and which depleted uranium might be part of that, because there is clearly nuclear warfare that does occur with the use, I guess, white phosphorus and so forth in the Middle East. And I think there's been reports of that under the Clinton administration with the bombings and former country of Yugoslavia. So it's quite sad to see these sort of decisions are being made. But one of the last questions we've got here for you, although there's a few more coming in from the Peanut Gallery via YouTube as we stream out here live on this 12th of January, 2018, 13th in Asia, around 2:30 in the afternoon. One of the last questions that we got here for you, though, are you familiar with the Hopi prophecy of the blue and red kachina?
No, nothing about that.
Okay, well, I'll share that with you later, I guess. There's not much you can say to it then. But yeah, there was something that came up, just was kind of passed my way in the lead up to the show today. Charlie Red Star versus, I guess, you know, the blue coloration as far as UFO reports and sightings are concerned. So yeah, just it ties into Hopi prophecy. I'll share that with you a little later, maybe after the show wraps here, of course. So a couple, just a quick kind of rapid fire, maybe questions here. Project Magnet. That is something that I guess initially kind of launched your interest in the world of ufology. It's how you first became involved back in 1970s.
No, that's what happened. That's where I went after I gave up on sightings. I said somebody has to know what's going on. And one of the people who, and this again, it's one of these synchronistic things. One of the people who had had a sighting worked in my father's office. My father was a pilot for the Canadian government, and it was a radar tech, and he had had a sighting. And so I got a sighting with nothing unusual. And then he said, you know, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study what the Canadian government was doing with UFOs. I used to work for the guy. And I went, you did? And this was the Project Magnet run from 1950 to 1954. It starts with Wilbur Smith, very interested in UFOs, believes that you can have some sort of propulsion technology by figuring out what these UFOs are doing, goes to the Americans through classified channels, and is told by the Americans, number one, flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. There's a small group headed by Dr. Vannevar Bush that's trying to figure out what's going on. It's of tremendous significance to the Americans. And then the most important thing, which I didn't realize till years later, and we were also told by American officials that other things might be associated with the saucers, such as mental phenomena. So Wilbur Smith runs this program from 1950 to 1954. He's sending propulsion papers to Vannevar Bush at the Pentagon. And in 1954, he sets up a flying saucer observatory. It has five different things they're measuring to detect UFOs. And this is in the nation's capital. This is in Ottawa. And the thing flies over on August the 8th, 1954. Wilbur goes public, and he said, if there's nothing wrong with the instruments, we've just detected the first flying saucer over the nation's capital. And that was game over. Government, no way. We're not going down this road. They shut the program down 2 days later, said nothing was discovered. Wilbur Smith could use the equipment, but he's no longer allowed to make any statements on behalf of the Canadian government. That was the end for the Canadian government. That was when the program shut down. So that's the program that was. But the only reason I studied it was because I'd given up on the sighting thing. And I figured I want to find out what's going on. And I did find out that the Canadian government was working on a program, and that they had been told in November of 1950, flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. And that was told to them by American officials, not by people on the street, by American officials. And that went through the Canadian embassy, through a military liaison who was dealing with the Pentagon, who got this material. So right from the word go, they've known exactly what's going on right from the word go. There's no big mystery inside the deep bowels of the government agencies that run this thing. They know exactly what's going on.
And a lot of disinformation, attempts to try to squelch or cover up, as you say, like to ridicule people who claim to have had sightings or have experienced things in a more direct fashion. So, well, there was a little bit of UFO hunting that was going on, of course, as you've talked about here, your Charlie Red Star days. One really interesting story that pops out, this will be the last talking point, really, and then we'll wrap things up here, mostly, well, partly the time limits that we've laid out, 90 minutes here, as well as the fact that struggling to keep my voice intact. But you, in your pursuit of Charlie Red Star, there was one night where you were out buzzing around in your car or truck, I guess, as it were, out in the back roads of Carmen, Manitoba with some kids, I think is how the story goes. It's interesting because this kind of ties into what we were just talking about as far as, you know, the powers that be and so forth. But there was a police officer that came up and asked you, I guess he held a flashlight out to kind of shone his flashlight on you. What are you up to? What's going on here? There's a bit of a story there. Can you share that with our listeners, if you don't mind?
Yeah, that was the scariest moment of my life. People will always describe this great fear that comes when you're in close proximity. From May of 1975, when we had the first sighting, it was all a game. We were chasing this thing. It was moved so slow. It was so close to the ground, and it would move so slow you could actually catch up to it with a car, or you could gain on it. So it was a big game, and that's when it changed. I think it was about April of 1976 when that happened. And I was taking some kids, and I was showing them these monitors, orbs, ground lights, and they were very responsive to light. You could flash at them. They'd flash back. You could go side to side. The thing would move back side to side. Then it was the only time I heard a noise. And what happened was this small object started to make this whistling, beeping noise, like a Morse code, except like a whistling noise. And I just absolute instant fear. I go, oh, my God, because there's nothing in this. I'm going, oh, we just the guys upstairs are going to be upset now. This thing's making these noises. And I looked up on the American border and there was this arc welding light. And I go, oh, and I took the kid. I said, come on, let's go back to the car. Let's go back to the car. And I was sitting in the car and I didn't know what to do. I was just petrified. These kids are bouncing around. They thought it was exciting. This thing starts to make the turn. I'm going, no, don't turn. Don't. And it made the turn and it started coming down straight down the road at us. And it changed from this arc welding light to a triangle. Huge, huge lights, two red lights on the front part of the triangle, like the flat end of the triangle towards us, and then a green light in the back. And it seemed to be on an angle, tilted on an angle. And I was looking, and then all I could think was to say to the kids, someone give me my binoculars. And I had to hold the binoculars against the inside of the glass of the car. I was in the driver's seat and hold the thing against the inside of the glass because my hands were shaking so badly. And I looked up and it was the entire field of vision. So it was either a very massive object or it was very close to the car. It was it hovered right above the car. And I was just looking up at this thing, and then it made, I describe it, you'll hear people, UFOs talk about, like they cut a film, and that's what it was like. It's like they cut the film, and this may have been lost time or whatever. It's just jerked the slightest little bit, like a film had been cut, and the fear instantly went away. It was gone, instantly. And this thing started to fly away, and then I was watching it, and that's when the RCMP, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, federal police officer pulled up in behind us, came up to the car, and I said, because I knew they'd been involved and they didn't want to be involved, and the thing, you could still clearly see this triangle flying away, and then that's when he stuck the flashlight, and I said, you see that object over there? And he said, yeah, I see it. And then I said, well, we're watching this object on the road, and we showed him. At first it wasn't there, then we took the light, we flashed in the light, and that's when he said, oh, it's probably just a couple of guys at the end of the road having a beer. And that's when I said, oh, we've been chasing it for 6 miles. And then he suddenly realized, triangle in the sky, lights on the ground, I'm getting out of here. And he starts going towards his car. And then I said to the kids, get his license plate number. And he's running. He runs into his car and he takes off with the gravel. And he sees three kids with flashlights chasing this Royal Canadian Mounted Police, federal police officer down the road with their flashlights as he takes off. So he doesn't get on the record. And that was that story. It was kind of funny how, you know, you have this very powerful guy, didn't ask for ID, nothing. It's like, I'm out of here. I'm not getting dragged into this thing. I guess because everybody knew that these things were being seen around there. And suddenly he was in the middle of this thing and he didn't want to go on the record.
Love that story. So we've had about close to 20 people here join us for our live stream. We are going to transition on into the after show. Don't know if Grant's going to be able to stick around or not. It's kind of late out there in Winnipeg, of course. But thanks to everyone who's been a part of things. One of the items that we'd like to draw to people's attention here via the live stream is how, according to Pirate Joe Aminon, in 1974, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer did a concert color film, Nassau Coliseum, played an extended version of Tarkus, and it included tones played in Close Encounters of the Third Kind, of 1977 Steven Spielberg movie production. So a little bit of movie UFO trivia for you there, folks. And just finally here, another question from the Peanut Gallery. I'm not sure why they asked this or how this ties into Charlie Red Star necessarily, but do you know much about David Serrata?
No, not really.
You've heard the name, but you haven't looked.
Oh yeah. I know who he is. Yeah. But I don't really, I mean, I haven't really followed his, he's never really lined up with material that I'm doing.
Gotcha.
The stories I do. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a big world, of course, the whole, area of ufological studies. And, once again, as probably I'm sure at least a few of our listeners know, you are one of the more prominent figures that, there are out there. And we just, to be clear, once again, don't typically go around looking for more outstanding names and personalities, basically for two reasons. One, because we feel they get enough exposure as it is. And secondly, our platform here is mostly out to work on promoting up-and-coming talents, personalities, voices, what have you. So, but we really do appreciate you being a part of things here, Grant. And that's why we did reach out to you just last year for the first time, as a matter of fact, because we really enjoyed what it was you were putting out there regarding Alien Rock. Once again, this Charlie Red Star follow-up is kind of a no-brainer. So a big thanks to your publicist, Jimmy, who I believe works out of perhaps the Canadian offices there as far as your book publication company is concerned. Let's hear a little bit about your book and how it can be, how people can get their hands on it and what the best way of doing that is, as well as, of course, your websites, which I believe include presidentialufo.com. Is that right?
Yeah, that site's being rebuilt at the moment. I haven't really put anything on there for a while, but my main stuff that I'm putting up now is on my White House UFO YouTube channel, where I'm putting a lot of the Zendra stuff and a lot of the updates. I'm doing a lot of the updates on this breaking story of the Tom DeLong, the Pentagon disclosure. I've done about 2 hours of updates on there, where I sort of tell you the latest stuff, and I'm doing one next Thursday that'll be out on that YouTube channel. So those are the two main places. I have a publishing company now where we're helping people publish their books. We don't really take any money for it, but we basically find someone who's got a good story and then show them how to publish their book. So we're doing some of that as well. And that's all, it's all connected publishing.
The name of the company is All Connected.
It's All Connected Publishing.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, on that note then, and just stand by, Grant, we'll talk to you just for a few minutes in the back end of things, whether you stick around or not. It's entirely up to you. We'll work that out when we kind of touch base here in the for show area, just briefly. Gosh, folks, you know, this is the worst that I have had to deal with as far as health issues are concerned in probably my entire life, and it's really hit me bad here with the voice. Of course, as you can hear, things started out not too bad, but kind of seem to have really flared up here for some reason. So I guess it's back to the doctor's office here come Monday in Korea. So just gonna let people know, of course, too, that we are, well, working on ramping things up here in 2018, hoping to do the best we can as far as bookings and so forth. Check out our Patreon page, Patreon WPRPN. Of course, you can also always catch us on Twitter and Facebook, minds.com, all those sort of great places throughout social media. And we're always open, of course, to guest suggestions and the like. In the meantime, though, on behalf of Captain Long John Sinclair, the Robin Hood, and all its crew, until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host, as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Jaffe Ryder. I know. There we be. Having carefully looked over each of our navigation panel instruments, checking every level, switch, dial, cable, knob, and pulley, by all accounts and indications, we indeed see it's time once again to drop anchor inside Mystic Bay and draw an end to another week of Pirate Radio Podcasts. Remember, if you're looking for a little more lively online action, keep in mind we've likely got yet another great free-flowing Rogues Gallery After Show coming up for the next hour in either Skype, Google Hangouts, or Peer.in. Also, if you've in any way enjoyed or found yourself benefiting from the shows we've tirelessly produced over the past 2 years, you might want to drop by our Patreon tip jar page and lend a little support. Half of all network donations go directly to charity. Help to keep those numbers growing over on Patreon, and we'll be able to extend even more of a generous pirate hand. Looking forward now to the balance of 2018, we're still not quite yet booked. So if you yourself have a new, novel, intriguing, or otherwise underreported idea, unique individual, or pressing item in mind, be sure to either drop us a line directly over on WPRPN.com or fire us a quick email via pirateoneradio@gmail.com. We're always open to exploring fresh creative suggestions, intriguing guest ideas, cutting-edge discussion topics, and captivating themes. You can further embark on your own personal pirate journey by either liking, commenting on, subscribing to, or just following us via virtually any mainstream social media platform, including Twitter, Facebook, Google+, or minds.com. So don't forget to become engaged. Until we meet again out on the high digital seas, I'm your host as always, the ship's chief communications officer, Javi Ryder. Tally-ho.